I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about the challenges associated with educating African-American boys. We're going to talk about what the needs are and how we should go about meeting them. My guest will be Kariga Rausch, Research Associate with the Center for Evaluation and Education Policy Equity Project at Indiana University, Rob Helfenbein, Associate Professor and Curriculum Studies Director with the Center for Urban and Multicultural Education, and Marcus Robinson, Chancellor of the Tembley Accelerated School. Please join the conversation. Call us at 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Twitter is WFYI. Facebook is No Limits WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the statehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about the challenges associated with educating African-American boys, African-American young men. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, I am joined here in the studio by Kariga Rausch, who is a research associate with the Equity Project at Indiana University. Kariga, welcome back to the program.
Very happy to be here. Thank you, John.
It's good to have you here. And we also are joined here in the studio by Rob Helfenbein, who is an associate professor and curriculum studies director for the Center for Urban and Multicultural Education. Rob, I think this is your first time with the show. Welcome.
Thanks good for having me.
It's good to have you here. Well, let's talk. I know we would get the question if we were asking, what's different about educating African-American young men or African-American boys? And I'm going to use that term for any that are under eight. Okay, I think we can safely do that without being derogatory. What are the challenges that come with that task that might not apply in other areas, Kariga?
Sure, and I certainly appreciate the question because oftentimes we think about our sons, our African-American boys, as somehow different than other boys and other kids in our community when, in fact, they're not. I think some of the challenges that we're seeing among that population of students is what they're not receiving that other kids are receiving. And a big, big part of that is meaningful relationships in schools with teachers and principals and other folks, and the kind of relationships that value who they are, value what they come from, value what they think, and ultimately and truly cultivate those kind of positive relationships. And we tend to see, kind of different needs regarding what those relationships need to look like. But indeed, our black boys aren't Martians from another planet who need something wholly different than other kids. What they need is what other kids are already getting.
Yeah, they're part of our city, our community, our life. Are there signs, though, there are data points, and I'm asking a question even though I know the answer here, Rob, that suggests, though, that there are certain performance standards or other areas that are of concern that are specific to African-American boys that support what Kariga was saying, that there are certain things they are not getting that others are?
Right. Well, I really appreciate Kariga's opening there because I think that's exactly right. There's a common term called the achievement gap, which at least in its first incarnation is about racial gaps in achievement. Interestingly, when it was first done, they controlled for poverty. Mm-hmm. So what you're looking at specifically is racial differences in schools. So one, we're very data rich at this point. There are a lot of questions that we didn't have good data on not that long ago, and now there's all kinds of data that we can put to work. The question is how do we take these different data points and put them together and come up with some meaningful descriptors or solutions or possible programs. But Kariga is exactly right. I mean, now particularly what we know coming out of neuroscience, which how learning actually works, is the critical importance of relationships and the socio emotional side of learning. When I was coming up training to be a teacher, that was called philosophy. Now it's coming out of the brain-based research. We know a lot about actually how learning works. And so I think that's a critical component. The thing I'd probably add, of which I'm quite concerned about, is, you know, how are we training teachers to work with young people that come from very different backgrounds that they do, or that they did? And there's a lot of talk and a lot of concern about training teachers and what's required in order to get somebody highly qualified and functional in a classroom. But I'm concerned about some of these programs and how they might strip away the opportunity for teachers to really reflect on what we would call cultural competency, or teaching all kinds of learners from all different paths and walks of life.
We are talking about educating African-American boys here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. We're joined now by our third guest, Marcus Robinson, Chancellor of the Tindley Accelerated School here in Indianapolis. Marcus, welcome back to the program.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Certainly. Well, I had just asked Rob and Kariga variation of the same question, which is, what are the different challenges that are associated with educating African-American young men or boys? And Kariga answered to summarize that there are, a lot of it is that there are certain things that other children have been getting that African-American boys historically have not. And Rob, I think, prepared us with some of the changes in teaching methodology and said that we now know a lot more about how the brain develops, and therefore we know that a lot of these socio-relational things that teachers have been... Oops, I think we just lost Marcus. So I'm going to throw the question back to Rob to talk a little more on the data points that you mentioned. What evidence do we have that this is having an impact? I mean, how when we talk about an achievement gap, how large is the achievement gap?
Well, the achievement gap, now, one of the tricky parts about this is you've got different kind of scales of analysis, right? So if you look at nationally, if you look at something like the NAEP test, which is the National Assessment of Educational Progress, it's considered probably the most reliable measure. What you see is that since Brown versus Board and efforts to desegregate, which of course was a drawn out process based on...
Some might argue that it's still going on.
I think so.
Yeah.
Many would. Or that we've reversed course and in fact we're re-segregating now. But if you look at that data, what you see is the achievement gap is half of what it was in 1980. So there was significant work that was done related to the racial achievement gap. Unfortunately, what you see with those numbers is that they pretty much stagnated. They haven't really moved in the last 10, 12 years or so. They're pretty steadily there. Now, the other thing that's really important about the achievement gap is it's the gap between lines, and all lines are going up.
Mm-hmm.
There's something about gap language that I think leads people to believe that we're doing worse than we've done historically, and that's simply not true. We are in a context, however, where there's different kinds of needs for educational attainment, and certainly the economy has shifted where there's a higher expectation in terms of what we need our high school graduates to be able to do and the potentials of college. So it's a bit tricky. Some of the new research, Gary Orfield has a new report. He's out of UCLA and does some pretty phenomenal work, and he did a report on Brown at 60 looking back at desegregation. And his concern is that we're resegregating, right? One of the results is a result of some of the federal backing away from legislation and formal deseg orders. But there's other things at work, too. And his concern is that historically what we've seen is that separate is not equal. And his concerns are that we'll continue to see those trends.
Yes, Kariga.
Yeah. And so, Rob makes, I think, some really important and excellent points. We know, for example, that there still remains a significant gap, even though all groups are increasing, you know, between African-American students, our African-American sons, and their peers in academic achievement in being placed in special education and being removed from school via suspension, expulsion, and a lot of other, you know, different indicators, mm-hmm. you know, that we have, you know, good, you know, data on. And I think a number of people have tried to move the conversation from the achievement gap to the opportunity gap, mm-hmm. right? The idea that, yes, we know these gaps exist. When you start talking about what the opportunity gaps are, that's when you start having a conversation about what things do we need to do differently that can close those gaps, right? Mm-hmm. What additional resources, what additional pedagogies, what additional types of practices do we need that indeed are gap-closing interventions, which is a much higher calling than just continuing to raise achievement. You know, no longer is it acceptable to simply say, you know, we're striving for excellence for all kids when you have these huge, you know, gaps, you know, between student groups. We have to, our goal as a country, which, you know, thinking about this historically, is a new idea. Mm-hmm. that we need mm-hmm. to make sure that all students achieve at high levels. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that long ago where it was accepted in our culture and in our society that it was okay for some kids, you know, not to achieve, or some kids to go into certain tracks, or some kids to go in areas that didn't result in high life opportunities. It's only been, you know, and historically speaking, the last probably, you know, 30, 40 years at the most, where, and maybe even less than that, where there, I think there has been a genuine adoption among most people in communities that are saying it's no longer acceptable for some kids not to achieve at high levels.
Mm-hmm. We are talking about educating African-American boys here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. You also can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Marcus, I think we've got you back, right?
Yes, indeed. I appreciate you having me.
Certainly. Certainly. Well, we've been talking about, and Kariga just said that the dialogue has shifted a bit from the idea of an achievement gap to an opportunity gap.
Yep.
How do we go about closing the opportunity gap?
Well, I mean, to Rob's earlier comments about cultural competency. At some point, I think in many ways we're trying to put square pegs in round holes. Mm-hmm. And so when we look at current pedagogical practice, what we teach teachers to teach, how we teach them to teach, it is generally congruent with a couple sectors of our society, but leaves out African Americans, Hispanic Americans, etc. And so how do we create the schools that fit the kids and the cultural context that they're coming from? I'd wager that we don't just have a black boy problem. I'd wager that we've got a boy problem in general. And so the research really is compelling around how boys underperform in American schools versus how girls perform. So much so that we started a school for boys in Northeast Indianapolis, especially in the middle grades, mm-hmm. Where we try to come up with strategies that are just more congruent with being a boy.
And what, you know, I'll say here, my mother was an elementary school teacher, and when I'm talking, I'm the father of both a daughter and a son, and you learn a lot of this stuff is just hardwired. You want to say, okay, we're going to give them, you know, non-gender specific toys to play with and all of that, and, you know, I give my daughter a truck and she'll want to make it look nicer, and I give my son a Barbie doll and he'll start banging on something with it as soon as he can. My mother would say, we've only known since the 1920s, though,
yeah,
that a lot of our early educational models are designed around the activities that girls like to do rather
right.
than boys. So if we're doing this, how should we restructure the educational process so that it works with boys better? And Marcus, I'll throw that one to you first.
Sure. Well, you know, we have a middle school for girls and a middle school for boys, and we do mm-hmm. some things that are characteristically different between those two schools. When we look at our middle school for girls, we have an environment very much built on affiliation. What does it mean to be supportive of each other, to work together? Mm-hmm. In the context of our boys' school, we have a team competitiveness environment. And so those boys are structured in multi-age houses, And those houses earn points on academics, on behavior, on athletics. If it's something we can measure, we attach points to it. Mm-hmm. And it becomes quite the heated environment with a high level of engagement for those boys. We use the same strategy at our girls' school. They give points to each other. You know, we're very concerned Yale House is behind in points. We'd like to give them 50 points. In our boy environment, they use that as a distinction of excellence. And so we have to, I think, to your earlier point about what we know about boys and what we know about girls, we have to create environments that really speak to how boys are wired. Because to Kariga's point, we are no longer in a position where we can say boys can underperform and go work in a factory.
Marcus, we'll have to pick that up on the other side of the break. We are talking about educating African-American boys here on No Limits. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking about educating African-American boys on No Limits today. My guests are Kariga Rausch, who's a research associate with the Equity Project at Indiana University, Rob Helfenbein, who's an associate professor and curriculum studies director for the Center for Urban and Multicultural Education, and Marcus Robinson, who is chancellor of the Tindley Accelerated School here in Indianapolis. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. Doug, welcome to the program.
How are you?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
I was a training coordinator at the Chrysler plant in Kokomo. It's been a few years since I was there, but we would regularly take African-American boys from the Kokomo area up to classes. They would take the class, and we would audit. And at the same time, we would be in that class would be African-American boys from the Detroit area. And it was a stark difference between the education, and I think this goes back to the resegregation. You know, in Kokomo, it was pretty even as far as the color of the skin of the kids, but in the Detroit area, the schools were historically, you know, African American, and it was sad because the boys from Detroit saw it. We would answer questions out loud, and they just couldn't get it. And the one kid finally spoke up, and he said somebody made a comment about them graduating from a high school, and of course, you know, they kind of laughed. But the one kid said, he goes, you know, they just pushed us through. It was just get us through school and get us a degree and get out.
Thanks.
So, like I said, I think it goes back to the resegregation.
Thanks very much for the call and the story, Doug. You've given us something to
You're
talk
welcome.
About.
Thank you.
Well, and that I think the phrase that's almost become the cliche now is the soft bigotry of low expectations. You know, in that it becomes easy to write off. Kariga, I think you were the one making the point that it's only relatively recently in this nation's history that we've come to the point where we expect all people to perform well in school. Or, let's be honest, you know, it wasn't all that long ago, a couple of generations ago, you pretty much had to be pretty well funded to expect to go to college. I mean, that was part of what drove our SAT scores and all of that down for years. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about what that does to first, you know, we've talked about this globally right now, and we've talked about it in terms of what it does, what that does to the young men involved, what that does to their lives. And then we can talk about, you know, why it is in society's interest to change that. But I think we probably ought to put this in a human context. And I won't jump on anyone to do that immediately. Who would like to go? Volunteer, Kariga?
Well, I actually think probably the best person to speak to this is somebody who engages, you know, young people every day. I mean, I do research in this work and can certainly talk
about
some of the graduations. But Marcus, I think, would be a great person to talk to.
Okay, Marcus, I think you've got your cue then.
Well, I think it's it's probably bigger than expectation. And so we certainly try to put an ambitious course curriculum in front of every kid. And so we can pretty much get kids convinced quickly that they can aspire to great heights. The question becomes of resources. Can kids who have been under-resourced for years, who might be two or three grade levels behind, catch up in a standard school day on a standard 180-day calendar? Mm-hmm. And so unlike their wealthier peers, they don't have access to the Sylvan Learning, the Kumon, the private tutors. And so under the circumstances, then once we lift our sights relative to expectations, everybody can go to college. Mm-hmm. Then you have to get about this process of what is it going to take to support kids in those new habits of learning. And so extending the school day, being in school sometimes 6 or 7 o'clock at night, coming to school on Saturdays, working through the summers. And so finding the resources, John, I think, to provide those kids with the resources to actually hit those ambitions, mm-hmm. tremendous.
Well, what does it do, I guess, and I try not to make this show about me, but I remember years ago volunteering at an IPS school, elementary school. And, part of it is in this environment that we're speaking about, there were no men in the school. I mean, the teachers pretty much were all females. So a friend of mine was the principal, asked me to come up, just do things like, play kickball with the kids at lunch. And I'd do that 3 times a week, organize games with them. And I could see at that point that, these kids, when they were in first and second grade, particularly the young men, and I probably would agree with Marcus's point, it wasn't necessarily the racial division wasn't the dividing line here. That because it was a poorer neighborhood where 97% of the kids, I think, were on subsidized lunches, that a lot of the boys were bright, enthusiastic, first, second, third grade. By the time they got to fifth grade, they'd begun to figure it out and had begun to see, okay, I can do everything they say I should do, but there really isn't a happy ending for me here, even on this path. And I guess I'd like for us to talk a little bit about the damage we do to the human beings involved with all of this. We can talk about the societal costs. We can talk about how schools ought to be restructured. But what do we do to those young men, Marcus? What lessons do they take from this?
Sure. Well, it gets really down to what is the business of school? Mm-hmm. Business of school, just a transference of skill, or is it something more important? Is it about human development? And so what you're really running into is, at some point, you have kids who need more than math and science. Mm-hmm. They need social and emotional growth. And they're at a point of independence by fifth grade, by sixth grade, where they are exposed to other influencers. And they get to be out in the neighborhood. They get to kind of set their own times and curfews when their parents work. And so if schools can't provide a more compelling narrative for those kids, i.e., you don't have to go home and hang out in the neighborhood because you are part of the lacrosse team, or you are on the football team, or you're part of the math team. I need you to help tutor the third graders. Then they're going to be exposed to a narrative that says school doesn't amount to very much. Mm-hmm. I'm surrounded by older people for whom school has done little benefit. And so how do I find my way into these other areas that seem to be more meaningful? And so it seems to me the role of school has changed. And it's not just about reading and writing and arithmetic. It's about your total spiritual and emotional growth.
Yeah, no, I would just add to what Marcus said and to the points that you made, John, that it's just fascinating when you look at the research. It's that, you know, fourth, fifth, sixth grade period of time where you start to see huge drop-offs in academic achievement and engagement for boys in general, African-American boys in particular. There are a lot of reasons for that. You know, one that's been substantiated in the evidence is they start recognizing the world that they're in. And they start understanding that there's some things that aren't equal here. Sometimes they have a difficult time articulating that. It comes out in a lot of interesting different ways. Mm-hmm. But they start to recognize that, you know, something's not quite right here. And that is also, from a developmental psychology perspective, one of the most important identity development times, right, for them, how they think about themselves, how they think about the world around them. Not that anything is set in stone, and there are opportunities to intervene even beyond, you know, that age group to help them develop a sense, a forward-thinking sense of who they are and what they're about. But it is during those kind of critical time frames, that late elementary and middle school years, where identity development becomes so very important in the way they think about themselves and their communities, which is exactly why that age group is so important to attend to.
Mm-hmm. We are talking about educating African-American boys here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Charles, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
Well, these gentlemen and you all, you have a very good program here. I am exactly, on the one hand, what you are talking about, and on the other hand, I'm maybe the exception. I grew up in a neighborhood on the south side that taxis wouldn't go into when I was a kid because they were told not to go into because it was that rough. And I have a master's degree from a Jesuit college on the West Coast, on the East Coast, pardon me. And there's two things. One thing about this whole discussion is and these scholars and researchers will know this, is nature and nurture, okay? And some of this is nurture, family, okay? Some of it is exactly what the last gentleman, which I'm sorry I'm forgetting his name, who spoke about the fact that the kids come up with identity. And this is one of the reasons why I wanted to call, because I've recently written a book and talks about me growing up in the 60s and recognizing that there was a difference between me and that kid over there. Mm-hmm. And that is relates to psychosocial stress that kids are coming under. I'm of the opinion, I teach philosophy and Eastern religions at the university level, mm-hmm. and I have lived in India, I worked in New York City, but I was raised on the South Side. I see that getting kids varied education outside their communities and whatever is paramount. I also see one of the tools that I learned about, which frightened me, and actually the gentleman, the chancellor at the Tinsley, mm-hmm. I would particularly like to speak with him. I'm sure he's familiar with Dr. Tom Brown. I've done some of the things with Dr. Tom Brown here in the city. But one of the things I do, and I've been doing for 40 years, your guest talked about alternative pedagogies or additional pedagogies. Mm-hmm. I teach and have practiced meditation for 40 years. Mm-hmm. Meditation is what helped me get over the thing your last scholar there said, the thing about identity. Because our identity, spiritual growth, the chancellor at Tinsley talked about. And we're not talking about religion. We're talking about helping the evolution of human consciousness for all kids. But again, I look in the mirror and my face is exactly the face of a kid that you're talking about growing up in this city. And oftentimes, it's being popularized now, mindfulness meditation. Well, I was practicing meditation before there was the coin mindfulness. Actually, mindfulness comes, meditation is mindfulness, but it's awareness tools, tools that can be used related to centering and having kids be aware and alert. Sometimes if you, again, back to nurture, if you don't get a good meal, you know, we all know these things. That's not really what this is about. But this alternative tools, which I've been using, and I attribute my 40 years experience, things that happened to me, to the practice of meditation, and this is something that there's the there's the wishy-washy thing about church and state, things like this. This is science. This is not religion. And that is a tool that I think, again, would be good for all kids. I'm particularly interested in it because I believe the kids who look like me could find this tool to be amazingly useful and help them to get over some of the hurdles that you guys are talking about.
Thanks very much for the call and the story. I'm gonna let the panel respond to it. Thanks again, Charles.
Well, I think there's several things that you could talk about there. I mean, one, I think it's an important thing to bring up is the idea of stress.
Mm-hmm.
Again, back to kind of the new learning science, we mm-hmm. know that stress is actually counterproductive in terms of learning. The point was also made about nutrition.
So high-stakes testing might not be the best thing in the
well,
world.
Well, we do a lot of that. We do a lot of that, and we do it increasingly, it seems like, because now there's tests to get ready for the tests.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a point. There's a point of diminishing returns where too much stress actually gets in the way of learning. A little competition tends to be generally good. It can be motivating, but there's a point where it drops off dramatically. And so I think there's a lot of questions and concerns about that. You know, originally when you asked the question, I've often made this joke when I speak publicly is, you know, there's three reasons to care about issues like this. And one is an ethical reason, because these are children, by mm-hmm. the way. Two is a democratic reason. Pick your founding father. You know, and any one of them said you can't have a participatory democracy without free public mm-hmm. education. I'm an old social studies teacher, so
yeah,
I have to log that. And then the third is economic. And the economic future of the city of Indianapolis, of Indiana, of the country, et cetera. And unfortunately, the only thing that anyone wants to talk about is the third one.
Mm-hmm.
But I think your caller is pointing to kind of the larger responsibility of education, which is about development. It's about identity. It's about sense of self. And it's about some things that are not going to come across on a standardized test.
Kariga and Marcus, I mean, does that frustrate you to a degree that economic argument is the – because Rob's right. I mean, that's the argument generally that's advanced for investing in schools, investing in education is job growth. To some degree, though, and I've spent a lot of time in and around and covering the debates over education in the past three decades, and at least what I hear Marcus and – Kariga and Rob, to some degree, all saying is the notion of education is different from what it was 30 years ago, or, you know, where we were talking about, you know, sort of basic subject areas and more into development of self, when a lot of the, you know, the forces, the people who are writing the checks to support education reform efforts are really most interested in developing, you know, a trained workforce mm-hmm. and not so much on the development of self. Does that create some frustration for you, Kariga?
It's an interesting question.
I try not to bore you.
I think all three purposes that we've just kind of talked about are all true. Mm-hmm. And because I believe so deeply that we must increase the life chances, literally life chances, of African American males, I'm less concerned with one's reasons, whether it's, you know, kind of economic, you know, related, democratically related, or to Rob's point that it needs to be underscored, these are children we're talking about, mm-hmm. right? Which should, you know, be a reason for everybody. Unfortunately, it's not. But making sure, but whichever, you know, kind of motivation or reason, you know, one kind of prism one sees this dynamic through, that can prompt them to do things that are evidence-based that actually will work mm-hmm. in terms of increasing the life chances of our sons, that's okay with me. And but also kind of undergirding that idea that the previous caller also briefly mentioned is this interesting duality that African-American males especially have to work through. Mm-hmm. And that's developing a level of resilience in them to deal with the context that they're in, while at the same time changing the context that they're in so they don't have to be so resilient. Mm-hmm. I think, frequently about, the message that I got from my parents, where they were my biggest advocates in making mm-hmm. sure that, schools, would be accessible to the needs that I had, while at the same time telling me you are going to face a context that may not always value who you are. You cannot use that as an excuse to not be great. And so I think sometimes we miss, if we focus too much on one of those versus the others, that focusing on both at the same time is really important.
We are talking about educating African-American boys here on No Limits. I am John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about educating African-American young men and boys. My guests are Kariga Rausch, who's a research associate with the Equity Project at Indiana University, Rob Helfenbein, who is associate professor and curriculum studies director for the Center for Urban and Multicultural Education, and Marcus Robinson, chancellor of the Tindley Accelerated School in Indianapolis. Rob, just before the break, Kariga was talking about, motivations for getting involved in helping schools. And he said, basically, as long as you're willing to help, I'm going to focus more on the fact that you're willing to help than your reasons for doing so. Right. You wanted to jump in there.
Well, and also the point about resiliency, I think, was a really strong one. And two things that I'd like to just tack on to that. Is one of the things we know about research in urban education is you have to, this is another way of saying Kariga's point, is that you have to have high expectations, or what some people call academic push. Mm-hmm. And I think that's coming out of Marcus's comments as well. But that has to be combined with social supports. You have to do those two things. Mm-hmm. And one of the mistakes that we often make is we do one mm-hmm. Really well, but don't do the other. And either way, without the combination, you don't see the
meaning we do the high expectations and there's
without
no social support
or the social support
and who cares?
Right. It's the most supportive environment in the world, but kids aren't doing anything academically. Yeah. So you really have to think about it in terms of that as a combination of factors. The other is that in my own work, even back starting with my dissertation, is I've been very interested in kind of where are these spaces of resiliency. And so instead of trying to write another story of failed urban reform, which I think there's plenty of and plenty of people writing those stories, I've been always more interested in where are the spaces where kids are carving out some room for themselves to push mm-hmm. And to be resilient within a system that is really set up for them not to do well. Mm-hmm. And I was just doing a focus group with some kids out at one of the alternative schools here in Indianapolis. And I was continually struck by how savvy these kids are. They know they know exactly what's going on. And they told me, this is a last chance school. Mm-hmm. This is it. This is our last chance. But they were motivated. They talked about that space. They talked about the way in which the teachers and the administrators interacted with them mm-hmm. and the very intentional choices they had made to use that space to try to keep moving academically. And my idea has always been, why aren't we spending time and energy trying to find those spaces? What can we learn from them and then create more of those spaces? If that's not the political project, then I don't know what is.
Yeah, I read a piece in the Washington Post, I think it was, a few days ago that took as a jump-off point, quote from Albert Einstein, said that everybody is a genius in his or her own way. But if you evaluate a fish on how well it climbs a tree,
right.
it's not. The trick is figuring out what the genius is in that case, identifying it and mm-hmm. and figuring out how to nurture it. We are talking about educating African-American boys here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. Dennis, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you today?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
A few years ago, I read a fascinating news story about the collapse and failure of education for African-American children, and I'm curious how your guest would respond. The thesis of the news story was that when Brown versus Topeka passed and desegregation began, that it caused the closing of thousands of schools that were predominantly African-American, and those children were sent to white schools. But the African-American teachers who had been teaching, sometimes for generations, lost their jobs. And this was a very, very highly educated population of teachers. Many African-American teachers who taught at traditionally black schools or African-American schools had master's and PhDs, but they were teachers, they weren't principals. And they held the African-American students to very, very high standards. And that when the African-American students lost their African-American teachers, that was where African-American education really, really collapsed and fell down. I'm curious if there's historical, I guess, if that's accurate, and what your guests would have to say. And I will listen off the air.
Thanks very much for the call, Dennis. I saw nods of affirmation here while Dennis was talking, but Kariga, I'll let you have the first crack.
So Dennis brings up an uncomfortable truth that I would say kind of manifests itself in two places. One is that I think there is a case to be made that we never really authentically tried integration at scale. Mm-hmm. And we can talk a little bit about that. I think the second...
Well, even here in Indianapolis, mm-hmm. I mean, the busing only went one way.
It only went one way. Typically, integration meant firing black teachers. Typically, integration meant putting kids in the same school building but on different floors. It meant having a higher proportion of kids of color in special education, school discipline procedures, those kind of things. So I think there's a case made that we didn't try school integration. Yeah. I also think there is... we have a very clear example right here in Indianapolis of an amazing, quote-unquote, segregated black school, and that was the Crispus Attucks, high mm-hmm. school, where my grandparents, spoke very fondly about the PhDs and the experiences they had in that segregated, right, black mm-hmm. school space here. And I think many of your listeners, especially African-American listeners, would equally say, they got something meaningful, out of that context. And a big part of it was the ability to prepare the teachers to prepare students for the world that they were going into. Now, I would argue that is not endemic to just a black school. Those kind of messages can be taught irrespective of the kind of school, but the social dynamics around that institution required that work. There's also a very interesting piece of qualitative literature that talked with African-American superintendents that had gone through segregated black schools and were now heading up integrated school districts. And their message about, was integration successful was, well, it depends. And I have a mixed appreciation and a mixed understanding of what that means.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of, to use your phrase, uncomfortable truths, I mean, how much of this, the challenges that we have faced, and I guess this is a broader educational question, comes from the fact that we probably, until... really, the feminist revolution, civil rights revolution, all of that, where there were parts of our population, many minorities, many women went into education because that was the only profession that was available to them. If you were accessible to them, so, a lot of people who, at least in our era, would have been doctors, lawyers, engineers, instead ended up being educators. Is that part of the challenge we face, Rob or Marcus, either one of you?
I would say absolutely not. Certainly a broader spectrum of opportunities for both women and minorities is something to be celebrated. Mm-hmm. And it certainly had somewhat of a deleterious effect on who goes into the profession of teaching and why they go into the profession of teaching. But the fact of the matter is, we still fully credential people to be educational professionals.
Mm-hmm.
And so to Kariga's earlier point of achievement gaps and opportunity gaps, what are we seeking in terms of equity?
And we would never want to go back to the pre-Brown versus Board of Education days when all black schools didn't just mean you had these really intelligent black teachers. It also meant you had crumbling and decaying spaces. You had a lack of resources. You had books that were 10, 20, 30 years old. You never want to get back to the point where you have black people in a scenario where they're woefully under-resourced. But because most of the profession, 80%, is white and female, then you have to step up to the plate and say, listen, for those of you who teach kids, no matter what they look like, there ought to be an equity, not just of opportunity, but an equity of outcome. We expect all of our kids to learn, no matter what they look like. And so if you're not good at teaching Hispanic males, then you need to get good, or you're in the wrong place. I think we would say the same thing about nurses. We say the same things about lawyers, right? And so only in education is this cultural divide permissible, right? It's okay to undereducate folks who don't look like you. And I think we just have to remove all the excuses, right? We know enough to teach African-American boys extremely well. The question is, will we ever get to the point where everybody must be accountable for those black boys that they teach?
Well, and I guess there does seem to be some evidence, obviously, that minorities are underserved when it comes to getting medical care, too, and other areas that unfortunately, there is a reason that race has been called our original sin in this country, that it's the thing we can't seem to get past. I guess let me flip that premise around, though, Marcus, if it were. Is part of the solution then figuring out ways to better reward and entice talented people into education as a profession, that it was a default profession because so many other doors were closed to them, and I don't think any of us want to go back to those days. What ways can we make education more attractive to the best and brightest in our society?
Well, I think first and foremost, you got to pay teachers more.
Okay.
You have to make it economically appealing to our best and brightest in society to participate. I also think you have to reach them earlier. We really have to go back and reevaluate what we're doing with pre-service teacher education and how many real hours that takes and what the real proficiencies are to cross that threshold and become a teacher. And you've got to be broader in recruitment of those pre-service teachers. They can't all be white females from suburban or rural environments. We have to get a more representative swath of society engaged in those pre-service teaching programs. And we've got to lift the bar. At some point, it has to be as tough to become a teacher as it is to become a nurse. If we expect folks to walk out of undergraduate school and into a classroom prepared to encounter all the rigors that takes.
We are talking about educating African-American young men. If you want to reach out to us, join the conversation via Facebook, as a listener named Katie has done. You can find us at No Limits, WFYI. And her question is, looking at whole child development, can your guest comment on Jeffrey Canada's Harlem Kids Zone? Kariga.
So, to the point I think that you made earlier, John, the good news is we have examples of schools and communities that are shattering the myth that some kids can't learn at extremely high levels. One of the things that Marcus mentioned, you know, before, and certainly looking at the Harlem Children's Zone, that's another really important example to learn from. Now, I preface this by saying that no school is perfect, right? Every school has things to work on. But the theory, the philosophy, and the enacted practice that Jeffrey Canada has demonstrated in the zone is that you also can't separate community development and community needs, you know, from kids' needs. And so for those listeners who aren't aware, the Harlem Children's Zone takes, you know, a large chunk of Harlem and provides not only educational, you know, resources and operating schools for kids, but also does healthcare development. You know, it does job training. It does, you know, adult engagement, you know, for the people in that community as well. So, yes, there's a lot to be learned from the Harlem Children's Zone, as well as a number of schools right here in Indianapolis. You know, we don't have to go all the way to New York City to find folks that are doing amazing work for all kids, especially African-American
kids.
Yeah,
that concept is similar to one I think that has been around here for a while called the Full Service School, where you make the school kind of a community center.
Right, Full Service Community Schools is a national model. Indianapolis has been at the front of the pack, I think, in some of those ideas. which does exactly that. And it predates the Harlem Children's Zone, although I think there's some amazing work happening there. The problem has been, how then does a school take up that charge within the other constraints of one, a large urban district, but also changing policy landscape and different regulations and those kinds of things? How does a school continually have to do it? What we're seeing with the community schools that we work with in my center is that it's a constant back and forth where they've got to respond to either district regulation, state regulation, redistricting, and you know, all these things are interconnected, you know. Mm-hmm. So even things like state takeover of schools, well, what happens when the state takes over schools is the district then redraws the catchment areas for where the kids go to schools, and suddenly whole populations can shift within a school. Mm-hmm. So again, I think we need really smart, thoughtful, inclusive policy work where we can really think about the implication of you're not supposed to laugh at that.
Well, what I'm laughing at is, you're really expecting that out of the legislative process?
Yes, doggone it. That's the kind of where we think about how the dominoes fall and how one decision impacts another decision is really, really what we need.
We are talking about educating African-American young men here on No Limits. John, welcome to the program.
Yes, sir. I think you mentioned the achievement gap. And I think you failed to point out that children growing up in poverty and in families headed by an unmarried woman had two strikes against them. And until such time as we really attack this problem of single-parent households headed by women, you are going to have achievement gap to deal with for a long, long time. It started when I was involved with a class in 1995. Now it's been almost 20 years, and it shows no sign of improvement because the kids are starting with a couple of strikes against them, particularly African-American boys.
Thanks very much for the call. Well, Rob, do you want to take a shot?
Well, certainly. I think poverty is something we absolutely have to keep in mind. And also, you know, fixing education isn't going to fix poverty, by the way. These are larger economic structures that I think are bigger than that. And sometimes I think education is a convenient whipping boy in a sense. Well, if you just fix the schools, then we'd fix the economy of the state of Indiana. I don't think that's true. And I haven't seen a lot of data related to that. But, you know, this goes back to something that Marcus kind of led off with earlier in the hour, is resources. Right. And how then can we, you know, when we've got folks coming to us from poverty, we know that there's things that we've got to do in order to build the supports for those kids to be successful. And they may be nutritional, right? Or they may be all kinds of other opportunities. It could be good after school programs. What's happening in the summer? And I do want to say one thing as I've been thinking here. It's been exciting to be in this city, particularly in the last couple years, where I think there is a new willingness to talk about public education and on a community-wide level. And there are people lining up to try to help. So I think it's a real moment for us. We're paying attention, I think, to some things that were uncomfortable truths. There's some conversations starting around the city that I think are very powerful, and we should take advantage of that.
That will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guests, Kariga Rausch, Rob Hilfenbein, and Marcus Robinson, for a very lively conversation. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Cedric Freeman. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.